Chapter 3. June 1947. A Sunday journey by motor car was never an arduous drive. There was little traffic, nothing much to distract Eleanor White from her quarry, the black Ford Pilot in the near distance. Yet the quiet roads meant Eleanor could not fail to be vigilant, aware of any manoeuvre on the part of the driver ahead to indicate that he was aware of her presence following him. The Ford proceeded along Old Kent Road, the London end of the original Watling Street, a thoroughfare that had crossed England since the Roman invasion, and was now almost consigned to mythology for its part in bringing news of the city to the county of Kent from ancient times, before London was known as Londinium and did not extend much beyond the banks of its famous river. Now that same road was bringing home the two men who had made life difficult for the young Mackey family. When the Ford turned to the right onto a street of larger Victorian dwellings that were once the homes of wealthy merchants doing business in the warehouses along the river, Eleanor slowed down but did not follow. She watched as the motor car braked, rear lights indicating the men had arrived at their destination, Mickleham Street. Checking the number of the house on the corner to her immediate right, number one, she estimated the property the men were now entering was number 15. 15 Mickleham Street, Camberwell. She had already noted the motor car's number plate, and now she knew the address. Slipping the Riley into gear, she waited for a costermonger's horse and cart to pass, then eased onto the empty road and drove toward Kennington, crossing the Thames via Vauxhall Bridge. Gaps in rows of houses and piles of rubble, where the streets had been bombed during 6 years of war, were still being cleared. Eleanor wondered how long it would take to restore the capital again, to repair the devastating damage not only to homes, but to the thousands of people caught up in the maelstrom of another world war. She thought she would be an old woman before London ceased to bear the scars of bombs, of firestorms, and of the V-1 and V-2 rockets that slammed into life itself. Those rockets were the most feared messengers of death, almost invisible as they buzzed their approach in the skies above until ready to fall. So quiet was their descent that people looking up, wondering where the rocket might land, would panic and run in all directions as if they were ants avoiding flame to the nest. Only a few souls would escape the explosion that followed. The bombing of Britain's cities brought death and despair along with a resilience that was already the stuff of proud reminiscence. Everyone had a tale to tell, but there was another side to the story. Wartime conscription had sucked in the bad along with the good, and while the bad could fight with an uncommon ferocity, they had returned battle-hardened and with darker skills in the art of killing learned in the prosecution of war. Demobilization had brought them home to the streets, and with a bounty of weapons that should have been left behind. Eleanor glanced in the rearview mirror before moving off again. There was more traffic now, but she retained awareness of every motor car and bus within a narrow proximity. Stopping along Queen's Gate, lingering to ensure she had not been followed, she turned into a cobbled street of mews houses, the brick and stone lane marked by its shallow V shape with drains along the centre. A mews was where horses had once been stabled, with drainage built to ensure waste could be swept away. She parked the motor car close to one house in particular, stepped out and opened the garage doors. Without losing a half second, she drove into the garage, closed and locked the doors, then made her way up to the first floor by way of an internal staircase. Not one of her fellow residents' curtains had twitched. Eleanor White was not aware of an onlooker, and she would have known if someone had observed her returning to the flat. In Belgium, during her girlhood, she had learned to feel the eyes of nosy neighbours, had learned to deflect their interest by waving or calling out a greeting to the elderly man at the window or the woman in her garden. And if she was staring out of her bedroom window late at night and witnessed a neighbour's return, she would remain silent. It was often best to remain silent. Often, but not always. The flat comprised a galley kitchen with an extension large enough to accommodate a dining table. The sitting room was situated to the left of the dining table, and from there a hallway gave access to two bedrooms, one of which would accommodate only a narrow single bed. This was the room Eleanor preferred. Within the close walls, she felt soothed and swaddled. She turned on the gas fire. Taking a match to light the jets, she did this first not for the heat, but the comfort of flames. Later, when darkness descended and it was time to switch on the lights, she would draw the blackout curtains, a leftover from the war, and breathe more easily. While her neighbours were not, as a rule, inquisitive, by the same token she had no desire to entertain a caller dropping by to say how nice it was to see her again. Supper would require only the simple task of heating a tin of soup. Eleanor had brought bread from the larder at the cottage, along with a small amount of cheese. She looked forward to the end of rationing because she liked cheese. First, though, there was one more task for Eleanor before she settled in for the evening. She had to place a telephone call, and could not do so from the flat, because she had never installed a telephone. If she could reach others with ease, it meant others could reach her, and she did not want to be reached. Eleanor left the flat on foot and walked back in the direction of Queen's Gate. Stopping at a nearby telephone kiosk, she lifted the receiver and slipped coins into the slot. She checked her watch, knowing the person she wanted to speak to would be at his desk. He was rarely at home, and Eleanor knew this much about him. If he wasn't at work, even on a Sunday, and often especially on a Sunday, then he would be with a woman who was not his wife. But Eleanor understood that his wife had entered marriage with her eyes open. She was nobody's fool. The line was answered on the first ring. Eleanor spoke before the male operator could offer the number and location. "Put me through to Detective Chief Inspector Stephen Warren, please."
"Right you are, madam. May I say you's..."
"No, that won't be necessary." There was a second's pause. Eleanor heard the man clear his throat.
"Of course, madam. Connecting you now."
Eleanor glanced right and left before turning to look through the kiosk's narrow panes at her back. "Old habits die hard," she whispered.
"Warren here. Who am I speaking to?"
"Eleanor." She heard papers ruffle and knew that Steve Warren had been leaning back in his chair before allowing it to fall forward, the landing of his elbows on the table causing documents on his desk to concertina and crackle.
"Linny! Linny, are you all right?"
"Yes, Steve, I'm well, but I want to see you."
"Well, there's an offer I can't refuse, Miss White. My place or yours, though my guess is you're not shackled in Shacklehurst."
"Tomorrow morning, Kensington Gardens, the Albert Memorial, let's cross paths there."
"Time?"
9.
"What's it about, Linny? Is it to do with—"
"No, Steve, it's not about the war."
"Will you give me a clue?"
"It's about a family, the Mackies. I believe you may have heard of them." Another pause. She thought she could almost hear Warren's brain cells jockeying for position in an effort to comprehend her answer.
"Bloody hell, Linny, what have you—" "Oh, never mind. I'll see you at 9. I'm looking forward to it."
Eleanor put the receiver down. "Yes, I believe you are," she said aloud. She left the telephone kiosk and returned to the Mews flat she had owned since the war, a property she had bought on a whim because it represented a future she could not imagine. Detective Chief Inspector Stephen Warren was with the Flying Squad, the Sweeney as they were known, Cockney rhyming slang alluding to a department founded to bring the violent perpetrators of organised crime to heel, if not to face justice.
"Sweeney Todd, Flying Squad. Get it, Linny? Get it? You know who Sweeney Todd was, don't you?"
Steve had explained soon after receiving his promotion. "That was quick, Steve."
"The joke? That's me, always quick."
"No, the nice promotion. That was fast." He had looked at her, his stare cold, as if he were reading her mind.
It was hard work and results, Linny. I work hard, and hard work with results maketh the man.
She responded with nothing more than a nod. He went on, defensive now.
They gave you a grace and favour house in the country for your trouble.
Her response came with the smile she knew would confuse him. And they gave you a grace and favour job, so we're even. It's all come right, hasn't it, DCI Warren? I'm glad it turned out so well for both of us. There was nothing Stephen Warren could say. She was right.
It wasn't stellar police work that had earned him a promotion, almost as soon as he returned to his old pre-war place of work, Scotland Yard, but another kind of duty. In truth, the other kind of toil deserved an honourable compensation, just as Eleanor deserved the house in Shacklehurst. Eleanor did not use the motor car the following morning, so it would remain in the ground-floor garage at her Mews flat until she was ready to return to Kent, a journey she expected to make within a few days, and early on the morning of her departure, before the streets, and anyone who might venture out at that hour, were fully awake. If she were honest with herself, she was not sure exactly how she would accomplish her aim for this sojourn in London, which was to begin to untangle Jim and Rose Mackey from the crosshairs of his family, but she felt compelled to take a chance, to give it her best shot. Alighting from the bus at the Royal Albert Hall, Eleanor crossed the road to enter Kensington Gardens and proceeded to the Albert Memorial. She had always been curious about the many tributes to Albert, Queen Victoria's consort. There was the Royal Albert Hall, which inspired her to wonder how many boys with the surname Hall had been burdened with the name Albert. And there was the Albert Memorial, the Albert Bridge, and a goodly number of streets named after Victoria's beloved Albert. Was Albert worthy of these tributes? Eleanor thought he probably deserved more recognition than some of the aristocracy. Linny!
Eleanor looked around to see a tall man walking in her direction, though he stopped for a few seconds when he saw her, then seemed to regain his lost composure before removing his hat and waving it to gain her attention. He wore a dark grey suit, white shirt, a silk tie and polished leather shoes. For a copper, Warren was a dapper bloke. The last time she had seen Stephen Warren, in 1945, at the end of the war, grey hair had only infiltrated his temples. Now it was more widespread, a salt-and-pepper crown that proved more attractive on a man of his bearing. She knew Steve would view this sign of ageing as an affliction, not a natural or elegant testament to time's passing. Yet, at least he had not resorted to dye. His gait was that of a younger fellow, so he wore the years with ease. He had retained the muscle and backbone trained into him, as had Eleanor White. "Steve, you're looking well," she smiled, but tensed as he leaned forward to kiss her on both cheeks.
"The Continental Way, Linny."
And there it was, that smile. "May we walk?"
"You lead on, ma'am."
"Jim Mackey," Eleanor began as they strolled away from the memorial. "What do you know about him?"
"Linny, I am floored that you seem to be giving in to this wild curiosity. Are you bored down there in the country? Nothing going on? Nothing to get the old adrenaline rushing around your body? Missing the intrigue, the challenge? Surely there's a welly-booted young farmer waiting to swoon over you, or a handsome geezer to liven things up a bit for the old girl?" He shook his head. "Look, seriously, Linny, don't get involved with the Mackeys. Even if your neighbour is the youngest son who for some reason fancies himself as a man of the land."
"I know a bit about the family, Steve. I make it my business to know something about everyone I meet, even in quiet little Shacklehurst. But you're the person with your finger on the pulse of his sort of people." Warren shook his head.
"His sort of people. Believe me, I wish some of those pulses would stop thrumming away and all those sort of people would just keel over like dominoes, or take one another out and be done with it. It'd make my life a bit easier."
"More than that, you would be on the streets jobless, Steve. Those villains give you a purpose, don't they?" Then where would your dose of adrenaline come from, eh? Touché, she thought.
All right, look, let's sit down over there. I know it goes against the grain for people like us, but we won't die a terrible death in a London park if we stop moving.
He pointed to a bench. They walked toward it in silence and sat down. Warren sighed.
The Mackies. There's history. And do not be distracted by the Gaelic-sounding name. The old grandad. His name's Francisco. Came over from Italy when he was young. Started off in the East End, then moved south of the river. He worked on the water, a lighterman. Well, that was his above-board occupation. He nurtured contacts at the docks, in the warehouses, and before long he was selling all sorts of goods on the side and making a pretty penny. Soon enough, he wasn't working on the water anymore. He was king of his manor. Mind you, he retained a partnership with the river, because as we know, where there's water, there's someone floating in it. He gave a half laugh. He and his wife, he married a London girl, born and bred, had three sons. The eldest is John Mackey, Jim's father. The old man called him Gianni. And there was Elisa Mackey, a sister, Jim's aunt, but they call her Elsie, and she married a Finch. Abe Finch was a small-time East End spiv, the sort who thought he was a big fish, not a tiny stickleback. The Mackies left him alone as long as their sister was happy, and Abe didn't do anything too stupid to damage the Mackey family fingers, which are in a lot of pies. Abe died of a heart attack after a doodlebug came down in the street while he was on his way to exchange knocked-off ration books for folding money. Pity the rocket didn't drop on Mickleham Street.
Number 15.
You don't waste any time, do you, Linny?
Go on, Steve.
Anyway, Francisco is nobody's fool, because from the time he got off the boat, he knew that when in England was the key to his intended success. So he gave himself and later baptised his sons with British names and in short order changed the surname. Francisco has been known as Frank for years, and I hear he can't control his bladder now, he's past 80. But he could always dredge up the eye-tie banter when it suited him to scare the schwant out of a few people, the sort of people who aren't easily scared. I'll give him this. It was almost as if he could see the war coming long before anyone else. Look at what happened to Italian restaurants and cafes after Mussolini threw in his lot with Hitler. And there were some in the Italian gangs who were taken off the streets and put in detention, whereas none of the Mackey lot were ever packed off to an internment camp, though you could say John's boys did their bit for the country.
Eleanor nodded.
Going back, by the time 1918 rolled around, the Mackey moniker was well established. And when war broke out again, memories of their original name were short. It's Marchetti, by the way. Mackey was a good choice. I've even heard people saying the family originally hailed from north of the border.
What sort of pies do they have their fingers in?
Oh, Linny, what pies aren't they into? They're well-established south of the river people now, as I said. But their rackets extend in every direction. John Mackey's middle brother, Joe, holds court in Liverpool. He married a local girl up there. John has London, and his brother Eric, Rico, the youngest of Francisco's boys, is in Bristol, though they've all got form here in the smoke and throughout the southeast.
He sighed.
So, let's count their ways, shall we? Armed robbery of banks and jewellers, robbery of racehorse takings, doping of horses and at the dog tracks, and, of course, fixed races. They have control of drinking clubs and spielers, the gambling clubs. There's a goodly amount of fraud, and let's not forget shoplifting. And we're not talking about someone picking off a few pairs of knickers in a local haberdashery shop. Elsie Finch, nay Mackey, might be small time compared to her brothers, but she has been running a little gang of women who are in and out of Harrods, Bourne and Hollingsworth, Dickens and Jones, Debenham and Freebody, Fenwick's, you name the shop, and they're pinching from it. Bond Street is a favoured place for Elsie's girls to wander in and wander out. That's how easy they make it, though As I said, her game is small fry, nothing as big as her brother's rackets, and hardly worth our bother. John Doe and Eric considered Elsie's pin money for doing all the hard work looking after Francisco. Eleanor rubbed her forehead and nodded. Jim was wise to leave, then. Warren sighed again. Linny, the kid had a good idea. And he's done his best to shed the family glue. No two ways about it. I take my hat off to him. But the Mackies have just been playing the line out a bit. They won't let him go. And time will tell. Italians are big on family. Linny, it's more than that. The Mackies are big on family, but not in the way you might imagine. There's no great affection between any of them. I don't think there's a sliver of personal loyalty to speak of either. John, his brothers and even his sister were foot soldiers to be trained up. And that goes for the next generation. It's a business, a cutthroat business. Warren sighed, stared into the distance, then began again. Every one of them has a role, a specialty if you like. For his part, Jim Mackey is the best driver in London. He could handle himself and win laurels racing motor cars at Brooklands if he had to. And on top of that, when he was demobbed, he not only came out of the army with a cheap suit, but he'd learned a lot more about engines with the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers and perfected his driving skills in very trying situations. And he doesn't want to do that for his family. That's the rub. Jim Mackey was detained at a borstal, you know, a prison for younger offenders down in Kent before the war. The lad was caught red-handed behind the wheel of a stolen motor car. His mistake was that he couldn't resist nicking a Bentley. But if I were to guess, I'd say he's the only one in the family whose heart isn't in it. He did his time at His Majesty's pleasure and was released straight into Remy's arms. God knows why they put a Mackey into the engineers, because with his previous, they risked him running off if they put him in the driver's seat of a bloody tank. Mind you, I reckon bomb disposal is enough to calm anyone down. Anyway, I think you know the rest. He met Rosie Phillips, fell in love, and that was it. They got out of the smoke as soon as they could. And now the Mackeys want him back. Warren frowned and was silent for a few seconds. Linny, if his family came calling, it means they need him. That it's Jim and no one else will do. Next time John Mackey might send all three of his boys and a few cousins down to have a word in his shell-like ear. Jim's older brothers are Bobby, Fred and Sandy, and that Sandy is a pig-headed violent sod with clodhopper feet and massive fists. Jim was persona non grata for a good while, but if they want him home, it's not because his mum misses him. It's because there's a big job in the offing. I would say he doesn't want to do it, not from the altercation I witnessed.
He might have to, Linny, and he owes them.
Those family ties?
You may know irregular war work better than anyone I've ever met, but you don't know organised crime. The Mackies will have threatened their younger brother with the worst-case scenario, which for Jim is losing his wife and child. As the saying goes, Linny, the boy can run, but he can't hide.
He rubbed his forehead.
And as I mentioned, he owes them. When Jim and Rose left London, it was in a hurry, because he didn't want to do a particular big job. He'd had enough.
We know that.
Yes, they let him go, mainly because Sandy, who has always had a chip on his shoulder the size of a 2x4, said he could take his brother's place, that he was as good a driver, if not better. But he wasn't. He smashed up the motor car during the getaway, and his face along with it. Yes, the gang escaped, and nothing could be pinned on the family. They had alibis up the yin-yang. Sandy was swept out of the country to a fancy surgeon in America, and that was that. Though the clever doctor couldn't erase all the evidence on Sandy's already ugly mug. He shrugged. Net result, Jim Mackey is in hock to his family up to the eyeballs.
Eleanor felt any colour in her cheeks fade. Steve Warren turned to her. Oh, now it's falling into place. He tapped the side of his head. How could I have been so bloody dim? It's the child, isn't it? It's Jim's little girl. What's her name? Susie? He put an arm around her. Linny, you can't change the past, love. Let it go. It's gone. We're home, and life goes on. Eleanor raised a hand, lifted his arm, and pushed it away from her shoulder. I can't change the past, Steve, but I will do all I can for Jim, Rose, and Susie Mackey.
Especially the child.
Eleanor nodded and whispered, All right, Steve. You're right. Yes. Especially the child. Warren rubbed his forehead again. It was a tick she knew well, a sign of indecision. There was a time when that same rub across the forehead was a warning to keep an eye on the man at her side. Keep an eye on him because any faltering could be the death of them both, and a whole line of comrades into the bargain.
All right, Lenny. Just this once, for old time's sake, come to my office, I've some people to talk to. And though this is irregular, to coin a phrase we both know well, we must all be in on whatever is going on. I've got to clear the path for your presence, so to speak, because the information you've brought to my attention suggests that we have to be on our toes.
She consulted her watch. Will you have cleared the irregularity by 1 o'clock?
Yes, said Warren. Come at 1. You know where to find me.
I do. And even if I didn't, I would find you. Eleanor recognized the look in Warren's eyes. Forget it, Steve. Not in that way. He shrugged.
Can't blame a bloke for trying. Miss White, let me introduce you to Detective Sergeant Robert Mills and Detective Sergeant Charles Kettle. Bob and Charlie.
Warren turned to the two men seated before him. Eleanor sat to his right.
Lads, this is Miss Eleanor White. I will embarrass her in front of you by saying she can go toe to toe with either of you when it comes to taking care of herself, so I would advise you not to get near her bare hands if you've annoyed her.
The men smiled, both nodding acknowledgement.
And to you, she is always Miss White. All right, added Warren. Yes, sir, said the men,
one echoing the other. Don't listen to a thing he says, said Eleanor, easing the introduction, which she considered unnecessary and inflammatory. Mills and Kettle were not neophytes, but she wondered if they had any idea of their superior's role during the war.
We'll have your back, Miss White, said Mills.
Thank you, added Eleanor, smiling.
Right, here we go. Miss White has provided me with first-hand information to suggest that the Mackeys are planning a sizable hit. We don't know whether it's a racehorse, a jeweller's bank, or even a bleeming great mansion where some lord is having a party to celebrate the fact that they all got to the end of the war without anyone knowing how much they loved old Hitler.
There was a snigger of laughter. Warren continued.
Bob, what's coming up on the racing calendar?
The big one came and went in March, said Mills. The Grand National, the 101st since the race started, and it pulled quite a crowd.
He smiled.
Nice little earner. I put a 5 bob each way on the 100-1 outsider, that Irish horse, Cahoo.
Go on, Bob. Now we all know you're in the money. Let's look at what's on the Gigi's dance card next, shall we? Royal Ascot is coming up, and so's the Derby. You're frowning, Bob, said Warren. Can't see any of the families taking on one of those. If it's racing, it'll be something else, not one of the big ones. Sniff around, Bob. If a horse loses a bloody shoe for no reason, I want to know about it.
Aye, sir.
Charlie, what about the banks? Heard of anything in the offing?
I've kept my ear to the ground, sir. All the big banks have tightened up security. They don't like spending their own money, but they're sick of being hit by armed gangs and their staff knocked about.
Eleanor shifted on her seat and raised her hand.
You're not in school now, Miss White, said Warren. You can just dive in with your 2 pennyworth. No need to raise your hand.
What if the plan is for something quieter? Not a raid, not a caper you might see at the pictures in one of those gangster films, but a plan with more stealth. So perhaps this time the need is for a driver who can not only manoeuvre a vehicle at high speed, but can seem like he's a delivery driver going about his business? Or perhaps it's a heavier-duty vehicle, something Jim would have been used to driving in the army. What if... Kettle interjected.
These gangs like to get in and get out, and they do it fast.
But what if they didn't? What if it's time for a change?
Sniff around, Charlie, instructed Warren. See what your informants might know.
Kettle nodded.
What else?
There's Hatton Garden and all them other wholesale jewellers, you know, with big safes underground, said Bob Mills. What with the weddings and engagements and a little more formality and romance coming back into the ceiling of a union, well, diamond trading is doing very well, thank you. Oh, and it's helped that Princess Elizabeth is getting married in November. Seems a lot of girls want to tie the knot in the same year.
Eleanor nodded. My father worked in Hatton Garden before I was born. Diamonds were his business. How easy is it to turn the stones into hard cash at the moment?
There's always someone looking for diamonds, Miss White, said Warren. You'd know that if your dad was in the business. They're currency by any other name.
And these blokes can sit on whatever it is they're after for a long time, added Mills. They're not desperate for a few readies in their pockets. They can play what they call a long game.
The long game? You're another one who's been skiving off to the pictures again, haven't you, Bob?
Just making an observation, sir. The detective sergeant shrugged. If you've got diamonds, you've set yourself up for a while.
Though Eleanor continued to pay attention and could have recounted every comment, every opinion voiced, along with plans to find out and fast what the Mackey family might be planning, the image that came to mind was her mother opening the seam along her sister's petticoat and removing one single diamond, every facet catching the candlelight. This diamond was food, sustenance. It was their school books, cloth for their uniforms. It was a safety net, their parents' gift of foresight, ensuring that together with other tiny gems their mother had sewn into the seams of their petticoats, they would survive what was now called the Great War.
Miss White? Miss White? Linny?
Sorry. Detective Chief Inspector Warren, you were asking how I could find out what else might be afoot? She gave a half laugh. I didn't expect Scotland Yard's flying squad to sound like a Sherlock Holmes mystery. She paused, meeting the eyes of each man. I was wondering, is there anything you can tell me about Elisa Elsie Finch? She shrugged. Just curious.
Interesting question, Miss White, said Warren. I don't think there's much to add there. She's the little sister, though she's no spring chicken.
He mirrored her shrug and brought his attention back to the men.
Right, let's meet here tomorrow. We'll pick over what you've come in with. Soon as we're a bit clearer on the intention, we'll bring in more shoe leather and I'll have a word with the governor. All right? Sir,
said Mills and Kettle, acknowledging Warren's instruction as they stood up to leave. They nodded toward Eleanor and left Warren's office.
What do you think, Linny? I know this isn't your bailiwick, but what's your impression after this little meeting?
My impression? First off, you've a pair of very good men there, but, Steve, I think there's a bigger game afoot, as you might say. It might be into a new field of endeavour altogether. She was thoughtful. Yes, my money's on a bigger game.
They would run the risk of being manor interlopers, then they'd have to deal with the likes of Jack Spot or one of the other gangs.
He rubbed his hands.
As I said, my dream is a dust-up where they all do away with one another without any civilian or police casualties, and there you have it. My work would be done, and I could escape to the south of France, or wherever people escape to, perhaps Brighton.
Perhaps. She stared out of the window, then brought her attention back to Warren. Or like a dictatorship, the Mackies could be planning a march into another country because they think they're strong enough and it's time to expand their base of operations.
Organised crime doesn't operate like that. Not now, not in London. They all understand how the status quo works. It's a balance. And there's honour among thieves.
Eleanor shook her head. No, there's not. We both know that. And the higher you go up the totem pole, the more honour ceases to exist. She stared at Warren. As I said, we both know that, don't we?